Welcome back to another episode of Perfusion. Today we've got Alex Woodward. Welcome, Alex.
Hey, Andrew. Thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
Be back. Yes, Alex co-hosted an episode, Dr. David Boyd, and he's back on. And he interns for us. He's 22. He's a senior in college, correct?
And yes, that's correct.
So we're wrapping, and his the depths of his knowledge are quite deep in the history, in the realm of what, world history, apparently.
Ancient times, in the world before our world.
So what got you interested in that?
Sixth grade history class, world history. I was just enamored with the amount of knowledge and amount of things and events that happened before our time. And it just really got me thinking about the past. So I just wanted to learn more about it and as much as I could to kind of just get engaged with it. And I started on YouTube and I just kept learning and watching videos. And I guess I've memorized quite a bit up till now. So that's just kind of how I got started with it.
What historical timeline do you study?
Yeah, so I am proficient in early Republican Roman society. So for those of you who don't know, the Roman Republic was split into the late and early Republic. The late Republic was dominated by civil war. The early Republic was actually the most stable and one of my favorite forms of government. I am also quite in depth in the Mongolian invasions from Genghis Khan all the way to the fall of the Mongol Empire. The Mongol Empire at one time controlled more land than the British Empire, because second to the British. The British controlled at their peak, they controlled 23% of the world's land. And the Mongol Empire controlled 18% of the world's land. So that was, and I know a little bit about everything, but mainly I know about the Mongols and early Republican Rome.
So do you know about Genghis Khan?
Yeah, Genghis Khan. Yeah, absolutely. He was actually, his given name was Temujin. Genghis Khan means great conqueror in Mongolian. And one thing that actually always confuses people about the Mongols is they don't know what religion they were. The Mongols were actually shamanistic, which means they kind of worshiped nature. They were like the Native Americans. They worshiped nature and they had shamans that would do rituals and stuff. But Genghis Khan actually grew up poor. Temujin, he grew up from a very poor family on the steppe. And he went through a lot of trials as a teenager. At one point, he was taken captive because he got raided by another tribe. In those days, the steppe was not united. There were all these different tribes. And his tribe got raided by another tribe and he was taken hostage.
Okay, so you
and
said
he was able to escape his captors and Yeah, go on. Sorry, Andrew.
What, the steppe? Is that what you said?
Yeah, the steppe. That's what the cold tundra in northern in Mongolia and in Siberia. There's a steppe there's a plain that rolls all the way from the Pacific coast, like we're near Vladivostok and where China and Mongolia are. It goes all the way to, I think, the Carpathian Mountains in Romania. So it's one of the largest and it's some of the most fertile land on Earth, in Siberia and along that corridor. It's flat, and that's how they were able to conquer so much, because it's a green sea of grass and it's flat. That's the steppe.
So why were they able to conquer so much because of that?
Because the Mongols were a horse-faring people, and the horses that they had were actually smaller than European horses. So European horses could only eat wheat. They had to eat barley because they were larger animals. They had to, in order to maintain their energy. But the Mongol horse breed were actually smaller pony type horses, and they were a little slower than European horses, but they were able to survive off of just grass. So because of that, the Mongols didn't actually have to have a sedentary type society like with farms in order to sustain their armies. And thus they were able to move along this very long grassy corridor all the way into Europe until they eventually got overextended and ultimately defeated and had to go back to Mongolia.
Who defeated them?
So actually defeated is kind of a wrong term. I'm misspoke. It's actually more like they had conquered as far as they could before their emperor died. So this was after the Great Khan. He was known as the Great Khan. That's like their ruler. It's like Caesar or an emperor. And Genghis Khan had died at this point. His empire was now ruled by one of his sons. I forget the name, but one of his generals, Subutai, was sent with an army of around 100,000 steppe warriors to go all the way to the Atlantic coast, conquer from, you know, Russia all the way to Portugal, and basically take over all of Europe. And they were well on their way to doing that. They had already defeated the Hungarians, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. They had defeated all of the armies in Europe that were the strongest that could withstand them. And the only reason they didn't go all the way to the Atlantic coast was because the Great Khan had died. And Subutai, the son, the Mongolian general, wanted to go back to try and get control of the empire. Because if he wasn't there, then the throne would be taken by someone else. And there was a big civil war after that. And that was the only reason the Mongols were turned around and stopped conquering.
So what I've heard like before, Genghis Khan is like 20% of the population in the world, right? Like, cause he had so many kids. You know anything about that?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. The reason he had a lot. Huh?
Yeah. What's that story?
Or can you please repeat the question?
Like he had a bunch of kids.
That story is Genghis Khan. Genghis Khan conquered pretty much all of the steppe. He was able to unite the steppe people, and he was able to conquer some of northern China. He was not able to conquer all of China in his lifetime, and he conquered a little bit to the west. He conquered quite a bit, and the Mongols would just go around, and him especially, he had a lot of wives. And not only that, the reason he has probably a lot of children is because the Mongols were they relied on brute force and brutality in order to keep the populations of the people they took over down. And they actually would they would kill whole populations of cities in order to keep, you know, control of this empire, because they're not very populous. When the Mongols controlled China, they were outnumbered, I think, 10 to 1 or 100 to 1. So the way they would take over territories is with brute force. And I think just a combination of Genghis Khan having a large amount of wives and also the depopulation efforts they went into when in these conquered lands probably proliferated a population more genetically linked to his lineage, which would allow him to have a larger population today that can trace their heritage back to Genghis Khan and his DNA ancestry. Because also he did have a lot of children. So think about, yeah.
Do you have that mic on? You got to bring it a little closer to you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, how many children did he have?
Yeah. So he had a lot of children, and his children had a lot of children, and also they killed a lot of people. So just his population was on the rise while he was killing a lot of population, and I think that's why a lot of people can trace their lineage back to Genghis Khan today.
Do you know how many kids he had?
I do not off the top. I can tell you he had well over 100 wives. And
oh wow. Oh wow.
All these wives had sons, and all these sons went out and had more sons, and it was in around the 1300s, so his line has been going through history for, at this point, you know, thousands of years. So, or not thousands, hundreds of years, not 1,000 years yet. It'll be 1,000 years once we get to the year like 2300 or something, because it was in the 1300s. So that's probably why he has a lot of kids.
Right. What else you got? What other history lessons? What's your favorite history lesson?
Yeah. So one of my favorite specialties in history is actually about the clever tactics of generals. And there are many smart generals throughout history. You've got Hannibal. A lot of Mongolian generals were extremely intelligent. You've got Julius Caesar, Napoleon, Alexander the Great. So one of my favorite siege stories from Mongol times is one time the Mongols surrounded a city and they wanted to capitulate the city, take them over. And they didn't have siege equipment with them, so they couldn't get through the walls. And what they ended up doing is they said, okay, we will leave the city if they got an offering from the city. And what they demanded was every single bird, cat, and dog from the city be brought to them. And if they were delivered, then they would leave the city alone. And then what they ended up, so the city was like, okay, cool. Yeah. So they gathered up all the birds, all the dogs, all the cats, and they gave them to the Mongols. And what the Mongols ended up doing was they took embers and kind of like a little torches, and they tied them to the birds' feet, the cats and the dogs, and they released them back just out. And what happened was the birds were nesting in all the houses, and the houses were made of hay and thatched roofs. So the birds would nest in these houses. So the birds, when they let them go, went back to their nests, and they basically ended up lighting the whole city on fire. The cats went back to the houses, the dogs went back, and the whole city went on fire. And then during this fire, the Mongols were able to infiltrate the city, and they proceeded to kill every man, woman, and child inside the city.
So what do? They kill everybody, and then what do they do?
Then they take it over. Well, the Mongols believed in basically two things. Either surrender immediately when they first come, and if you resist even a little bit, they will kill everyone inside your city, including the dogs, the animals, anything living they will kill, because they relied on brute force, and their reputation preceded them to most cities. So they were able to take over a lot of land without actually fighting, because just people knew that if they resisted, the chances of them dying were extremely high. And the Mongols were actually quite benevolent rulers. They believed in religious freedom. They didn't tax heavily on the population. They were actually quite nice. And also, when they did conquer lands, they would make special efforts to keep the engineers, the doctors, the construction workers, all the artisans alive so that they could help bolster the economy. They did believe in education, and they kept a lot of the siege engineers they would keep, and they would help them take over other cities. For instance, they used a lot of Chinese engineers, siege engineers, to take over some European cities, believe it or not. So they were, because they had taken over China, and they would always leave, if you were a profession, they would leave you alive. But if you were just like a farmer or a commoner, they would kill you. And one of the other really cool ways they would take over land is they would practice what's called a circle hunt, or I don't remember the Mongolian word, but the premise is that you encircle an entire area, let's say a 10 square mile area. And you basically in a circle with your hunters, and there would be, you know, thousands of hunters doing this. And then you would slowly over a couple days close the circle, and anything living would get scared and get tighter and tighter inside the circle. And the premise would be that all the animals that were spread over 10 miles are now in, say, you know, an area the size of a football field. So it's much denser with all the animals because you've scared them together. And then what they would do is they would let the nobility would hunt and get food for themselves. And then all the lesser generals would hunt for themselves. And then the peasants would get, not the peasants, but the lower Mongolian warriors would get to hunt all the food. And this was actually a tactic they applied in war. For instance, if a single, this was during training, if a single animal got through the blockade, essentially, the hunter that let the animal get through would be punished severely. It was seen as a great disgrace to let an animal through. And this was actually done from birth with the Mongolian warriors. And so when this was actually an exercise they would practice in real life. So if you take the same tactic and apply it to a city, you make it even larger. You take hundreds of thousands of warriors, surround an area around an entire city, maybe 100 square miles. That might be a little large, but like maybe 50 square miles. And you actually scare everyone, burn everything, and just send all the peasants into the city. And you're, first of all, what you're doing is you're causing terror. They're bringing stories of these monsters that are burning their land, their fields, and they're, you know, increasing the fear of the garrison inside the city about the Mongols. And they're also swelling the city's population. So a city might have 10 years of food, but if you swell it with all the people within a 50, you know, mile radius, then you're not going to be able to hold out much longer. That's a lot of people coming in, and that would also exacerbate the city's situation and predicament, and this would often lead to a Mongol victory in the city.
All right, so the Mongol, so
those are some interesting siege tactics.
The Mongolians were shameless. What else? What about Napoleon?
Basically,
they were what?
Yeah, so Napoleon, he was famous for what made him so effective in the field was, imagine a massive army that would basically lumber around, you know, supply trains, and the army would be stretched for hundreds, not hundreds of miles, but maybe 50 miles, because there's, you know, 200,000 to 300,000 men in the army. And they're just slow. I mean, if you've ever tried moving just by yourself, you're quick, you know, but if you have to bring your family or all your friends, you know, you've got to wait on all these people. So you're much quicker by yourself. So Napoleon realized this. So what he did was he took his massive 300,000 person army, and all he did was split it up into smaller armies that could be self-sufficient for a certain period of time. All these armies had their own artillery detachments, had their own skirmishers, had their own line troops, had their own supplies. So they were able to act independently of the main army. And this was called the corps system. And this system was later adopted by every single European country. And Napoleon, that was one of the big revolutions he did. In this corps system, imagine you're facing off an army of, both armies have 300,000 people, but one army is doing the old way of just having one army move of 300,000 people around. But what Napoleon did, he split his 300,000 into corps, which each corps had around 30 to 15,000 men in it. So now you've got 10 smaller armies facing up against a larger army. And what they were able to do is simply outmaneuver them. And they were able to also forage off the land more, because if you have 300,000 men in one village, you know, that village isn't going to go very far. But if you've only got a couple thousand guys in there, that village might be able to sustain that smaller army for a larger period of time. And if your army is spread over a greater area, you're also not depleting your resources, because when armies would march through a place, you know, imagine a large army, it's like a locust infestation. It just kills everything and makes it they're harvesting things unsustainably to where they could come back. You know, they just kill everything. But whereas with this core system, the armies were able to sustainably and holistically take food from these regions to where they'd be able to come back and get food again. They didn't destroy the infrastructure to get all the food, basically. They didn't eat everything, is what I'm saying. So using this revolutionary system, he was able to outmaneuver his enemies. And quite frankly, it was just better, because you could be over a wide region. I mean, you could have a whole corps. You could have 10 corps over Italy, for example, which he did have in northern Italy. He split his army up, and that's how he was able to defeat the Austria-Hungarians and the Russians.
Well, what year was that?
This was around 18. The Napoleonic Wars lasted from about my dates are probably wrong, but it was in the early 1800s.
So how do they communicate, though, if they got so many little pods, you know?
Yeah, so that was also one of his revolutions. He just, not revolutions. He just had very good messengers. So basically you'd write a note and you'd get a guy on a horse and he would just ride. And when his horse got tired, he would immediately be greeted with another horse and he would also ride. So he's basically a horse. I don't know exactly the range of a horse before it has to be watered and fed, but he would basically ride a horse to its limit, get on a new horse and then keep riding. And then, you know, because an army can march about, I think one of the fastest army marches was 160 or 120 miles in about 48 hours. So his armies could march pretty quickly. And especially a smaller force can march much faster than a larger force. So that's, they would just use horse messengers to answer your question.
Yeah.
What else you got? And he would also do a lot with,
What else you got?
What were you going to say? Yeah. What else? He was also, He was famous for his outmaneuvering of armies. He would basically be able to read the enemy commander's somehow's mind, and almost all of his predictions were correct. So, for instance, he would lure you into, he would weaken one part of his force or make it appear weakened, and then he would attack you while you were engaged with the smaller force. He would outflank you. He would do things like light. He would send out maybe 100 of his men to, you know, near the enemy camp, not near the enemy camp, but he would send them far away. And he would make the enemy think they were the main army. So when the enemy scouts spied on these 100 men, the men had lit like hundreds and hundreds of bonfires, you know, over a large area, so that the scouts thought that was the main force, when in reality he's camping like 20 miles to the south. There was one time he was trying to cross a river, and if he wasn't able to cross it, he would basically lose his entire army. And he was able to make the enemy general think he was going to cross in the north, so the enemy general moved his whole army to the north when he was actually going to cross in the south. So he was just unbelievable at predicting the enemy's move and basically making the enemy think where he wanted him. He got him to think what he wanted him to think and do what he wanted him to do, and he would use that against him. And he beat every single general every time. The only defeats he suffered were defeats due to him not having the main trained troops. These were all fresh conscripts, because a lot of his troops were killed because he'd been at war for 10 years. I mean, the French population after the Napoleonic War, they had lost 20% of their adolescent male population from the ages of, say, 18 to 30, because they had drafted so many people. Millions and millions of people died in the Napoleonic Wars. You know, not comparable to World War One, which I think saw around 10 million deaths. World War Two saw 40 to 60 million deaths overall. So, you know, it's not compared to those conflicts, but he was just a master at strategy.
It sounds like he had mind control.
Yeah.
Wasn't he a little guy?
Yeah. Well, a lot of it was basically it was extreme manipulation. So if he wants you to attack on his right, he'll take some of his weakest troops and put them on the right flank, and then you'll take the bait and attack the right. Meanwhile, he's got some of his best troops hiding in the bushes behind you, and he's going to come and attack you and take you out. But Napoleon, and what we can learn from all these generals, is they were always studying generals before him. Julius Caesar studied Alexander the Great. Napoleon studied Julius Caesar and Alexander the Great. You know, Hannibal studied Alexander the Great, because Alexander the Great was one of the first generals to like do a lot of this stuff, because he was in way early history. And just, they always studied and they were always extremely smart. They read a lot. They all had great teachers. Napoleon came from Corsica. He wasn't even French. Most people don't know that. Napoleon was Corsican, which is a small island off the coast of France. And Sardinia? He was either from Corsica or Sardinia. But when the French took over, it was Corsica. When the French took over Corsica, they actually, his family was minor nobility, and they had sided with the French during the takeover. And so they were able to send Napoleon to a school that was made up of a lot of snotty, it was in Paris, and it was made up of a lot of snotty French kids. And he was actually bullied a lot for his Corsican nobility and for not being fully French. All these French aristocrats' sons would bully him. He would fight back, but he was actually extremely, he was a loner. And actually, he was ugly by many accounts. Napoleon was not a good-looking guy. He was short. He wasn't short because 5'8 was actually the average height of the time, but he was ugly and he was bullied in school. And he didn't actually get luck with women until he was a powerful general. They only wanted him for the power. They never thought he was attractive at all. And he just read a lot. He spent a lot of time alone reading all these accounts of ancient generals. And eventually he joined the army and became a corporal. And then there was actually an account of a British soldier during the battle of, I can't remember the name of the town, but I think it's Toulouse, or it's a coastal town that the British had taken from the French, and the French were besieging that town to take it back because it was on French soil. And there was a army sergeant on the British side that almost killed Napoleon as a corporal with his bayonet. And if that sergeant had killed Napoleon, then we wouldn't have the Napoleonic Wars or any thing from that era, because he would have died. And after that, he showed his prowess by, they had their artillery that was bombarding the British city on the ground, but he said, let's move it to the high ground, let's move it to the mountains, and then bombard the city. And then they quickly surrendered after that, and he was able to take them over. And from there, he was promoted to lieutenant, and he served his general well as a lieutenant. And then he was moved up to general. He was given his own command in Italy. In northern Italy, he was given an army of about, I think, 60 to 70,000 men. And he led them against the Austria-Hungary and the Russians. And he was actually supposed to be a diversionary force because there were two other armies in the north of France that were invading Russia and Austria-Hungary through Germany. And because Germany at this time was not a united nation, you know, you had Prussia and then you had the Holy Roman Empire, which was a lot of duchies and all kinds of princedoms. It was well over 100. It was a big mess. It wasn't like the Germany we know today, Prussia being the biggest of those states. And basically what happened is Napoleon ended up stealing the show. He was able to take over several victories. And if you look at those campaigns, there were two or three times where he risked everything on one maneuver. And if that maneuver had not worked, his army would have been destroyed. He would have been disgraced and even possibly executed by the French higher ups for failing in his mission. Because in those days, generals were held personally responsible for their failures. Or he may have not been executed, but he would have been imprisoned or disgraced. And he was able to do that. And then after that, he was promoted to brigadier general and general over the entire French army. And then lucky for him, the French Revolution started, and then he basically marched into the capital one day flanked by his grenadiers. And he said, all right, I'm going to run the show now. I'm in charge now. And then he basically started a whole war with Europe, and no one liked that. So he had everyone against him in Europe. He had the Spanish against him, the British against him, the Prussians against him, the Russians, the Swedish, everyone in Europe, the Austria-Hungaries, no one liked him. And he defeated all of them and kept them at bay and actually won a lot of stuff for about 10 years. His big downfall, however, which it all is apparently all for these great generals and empires, is invading Russia in the winter. That's just something you don't do. He took about a million men into Russia. He beat them a couple times. The Battle of Eylau was actually one of the bloodiest battles during this time. No one really gained anything from it. They just lost a lot of men. It was cold and it was just a terrible slaughter. And eventually the Russians, he pushed them all the way to Moscow, and the Russians were like, we're just going to let him have the city and just keep retreating east. And they kept retreating east. And the Russians were like, but we're not going to let him have the city to quarter. And so they went to the prisons. They emptied them and handed them torches, said, oh, go burn down Moscow. Don't let the French have it. So all these Russian prisoners would just go all over the city, burning everything while the main Russian army retreated. and Napoleon was able to occupy Moscow. And at the time, if you think about it, he's like 1,000 miles from home. His supply lines are overstretched and he can't just keep retreating. He can't just keep chasing the Russians. So he made the decision to go. And the Russians at this time, Moscow was not the capital of Russia. I believe it was Peter the Great had moved the capital of Russia to St. Petersburg, which was named after him, obviously. And because so Moscow was not the capital. And Napoleon thought by taking over Moscow, he would get Peter the Great to at least surrender, which Peter the Great, he didn't get what he wanted and he had to retreat back home. And he lost like 90% of his troops. He only got home with around 100,000 men. And he drafted a lot more men, but that was like his grand army. That was the most men he had. It was actually the largest army assembled, I believe, in European history at this point. And he just didn't have the troops. All the other troops that he drafted were not as well trained. And eventually the coalition got back together. The Russians got more men. And the Russians actually were one of the biggest players in Napoleon's defeat. They lost a lot of men to Napoleon, and they actually marched their army into Paris. And so the Russian army actually occupied Paris, the Elbe of Italy. And then what happened was he basically snuck off the island, hijacked a boat, got back to the mainland, and the coalition had installed a French government to govern in his stead. And the coalition government sent some troops to arrest him. And those troops were old troops of his. And they basically followed him. The more longer he went, the more troops he gathered. And then he was able to amass an army. And then he overthrew the newly installed government from the coalition. And I think the sixth coalition war was started. And he was able to assemble a huge army to defend France, but it just wasn't enough. These were all untrained men. He was defeated at the Battle of Waterloo, and then he was sent way far south to the island of St. Helena, which is between Brazil and the Gulf of but it's way south in the South Pacific, not South Atlantic. It's an extremely secluded island. He was put there with none of his troops. The island was patrolled by 2 British corvettes 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, to make sure he wouldn't escape that island, because they didn't want him coming back causing more trouble. So he actually died there. And I don't remember if he was buried on St. Helena or if his body was carried back to France and buried. But he had controlled all of Europe pretty much at one point. He had Russia, he had Spain. So that was the kind of extent of the French Empire in Europe. The French also at this time had a very large colonial empire too. But that was the story of Napoleon.
Yeah. What about, you mentioned Hannibal. What is that? Do a quick story on that.
Yeah, okay. Hannibal was born after the first Punic War with Republican Rome, and Rome had defeated Carthage. So Hannibal is from Carthage. Rome had defeated Carthage in the first war, and they actually, unfortunately, got a very bad peace treaty from the Romans where they had to pay them a bunch of silver. Their navy was slashed, so they couldn't have as large of a navy, and it was extremely humiliating for Carthage. And Hannibal was born, and his father made him swear an oath to get revenge on the Romans for what they did to Carthage in the first Punic War. So Hannibal, long story short, the Carthaginians went into southern Spain because there was a lot of silver there, and they said Romans didn't own Spain at this time. So they went into southern Spain in order to defeat all these tribes and basically get these silver mines up and running to pay the Romans back. So the Romans sent an envoy to Carthage, and they're like, what are you doing in Spain? And they're like, oh, we're just getting money to pay you back. Nothing to worry about here. They're just like, okay, just don't expand more in Spain. Just stay here. And what happened was Hannibal, basically the Carthaginians were like, okay, Hannibal, here's an army, march from Spain to Rome and basically go teach those guys a lesson. So he marched from Spain across the southern part of France all the way to the Alps. And a lot of people, obviously everyone knows, or people might not know this. Then he crossed through the Alps and then attacked the Romans essentially from the rear, because they thought no one would be dumb enough to bring an army through the Alps during winter, but Hannibal was. He lost a lot of his elephants during that hike, and he also lost about a third of his army going through the Alps. And a lot of people don't know this. There were a lot of rocks in the way from the Alps. So what he would do is he would actually, in order to break up these giant granite boulders, essentially, that were blocking his way, they would build a fire under the rock. They would superheat it, and then they would pour wine, and I think they'd pour vinegar or wine on the rock, and that would somehow make it extremely brittle. And then they were able to break the rock apart and into smaller pieces and clear the way in order to get through the Alps. It's because they had a lot of wine and vinegar with them, and also spare wood to create fires. So they were able to make it through the Alps into what's called the Po Valley in northern Italy. And they gathered a lot of Gauls. Gauls were basically ancient French people that used to exist in northern Italy and in France. They still exist today, but, you know, as we know, they were taken over by the Romans. And but at this time, Rome didn't own northern Italy. A lot of the Gauls were there. So he got a lot of them to his cause, and he was able to defeat the Romans a lot. Three of the greatest defeats in Roman history in this order were the Battle of Trebia Forest, the Battle of Lake Trasimene, and then the Battle of Cannae, which was the largest defeat in Roman history. And it's also, as far as I know, the most men slaughtered in a 24-hour time frame. I think it was around 90,000, like actually all killed by a sword, not with guns, in the ancient times. So that was pretty brutal. And what happened was basically Hannibal, there's an old saying that says Hannibal knew how to attain a victory, but not how to use it. So he was really good at getting victory, but he didn't capitalize on it. He did not march on Rome at this time. He was free to go after the Battle of Cannae to march on Rome and take over the Roman Empire. But for some reason, historians still debate to this day, we don't know why he didn't march on Rome. Instead, he marched south of Rome and attacked some settlements down there and just kept burning farmland. But and then eventually he was defeated by the Roman army. He wasn't actually defeated in the Roman army. He was recalled back to Carthage, because at this time Rome had launched a separate invasion of Carthage, which is in modern day Tunisia in North Africa. And he was recalled back to Carthage to defend the homeland. And he was eventually stripped of his rank for his failure to basically capitulate the Romans. And that's kind of Hannibal's story in a nutshell.
Dude, I hope our audience is either very interested or fell asleep.
Yeah, that's a lot of information. It's not for everyone, but, you know, it lets you know where we came from. And, you know, that was a little bit of interesting history for everyone.
Yeah, for sure. All right, we'll have to catch up again later. I gotta take a nap.
Okay, great to be here, Andrew.
Thanks, Allie.
Okay.